Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 29th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Each week, we tackle the tough calls, bad behavior, and social significance of journalists and the companies they work for. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and joining me this week are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Amy Simons and Ernest Perry. What we're talking about this week, the Attorney General says he has, quote, a creeping sense of personal remorse over the probe of a Fox News journalist. A St. Louis TV reporter loses his job over comments about President Obama and the IRS. Two companies are ratcheting up efforts to serve news nuggets on your smartphone. Facebook faces blowback from users and advertisers over its inability to curb hate speech aimed at women. And CNN's Wolf Blitzer asks the wrong tornado survivor about divine intervention. Well, every time the White House thinks it might have handled the crisis du jour, something new seems to pop up. Last week, as Amy and crew discussed on Views, it was revealed that the Justice Department had looked at Fox News reporter James Rosen's emails with a State Department employee. In asking for a search warrant and permission to look at the emails without telling the news network, the DOJ said Rosen might have illegally conspired with leaker Stephen Kim to publish classified information about North Korea's nuclear program. News and free speech groups cried foul. Some even described the Rosen case and a similar probe involving the Associated Press as evidence of an Obama administration war with journalists. Veteran CBS journalist Bob Schieffer didn't go that far last Sunday on Face the Nation, but he did attempt to put the two stories in a larger context.
So I am glad the president has asked the attorney general to review whether his investigations into leaks is having a chilling effect on journalists. But it shouldn't stop there. The president needs to rethink his entire communications policy, top to bottom. It is hurting his credibility and shortchanging the public. And to head the review, how about someone other than the attorney general whose department is so deeply involved?
In fact, much of the fire this week has been aimed at Attorney General Holder. Why did he personally authorize tactics that seemed to criminalize Rosen's behavior? What would he do to keep such abuses, as perceived by the media at least, from happening in the future? Well, Amy, from at least a purely PR perspective, the administration seemed to get what the problem was about. The president promised an investigation. Holder was described as being sympathetic in a Daily Beast story, feeling personal remorse, and even decided he was going to start inviting in journalists, heads of the news bureaus this week, to talk about how they might change the rules.
Well, that's good and well. The part that I think is still leaving a lot of journalists questioning the sincerity and the legitimacy of this investigation is that Holder is investigating himself, which is an outright conflict of interest and in leading a lot of folks to wonder just how serious of an investigation it's really going to be. How well can you investigate yourself?
Can you investigate yourself? Should Congress or the president appoint somebody special to look into this?
I think from a PR standpoint, it would be good for the president or the attorney general himself to appoint someone else to do the investigation. But I think it goes back to something that we talked about last week, which is, you know, how far is this story really getting out? It sounds like you have the press sort of trying to defend itself or trying to make itself look like the victim here. Mm-hmm. And then you also have the administration basically saying, okay, mea culpa, we'll try to work this out with the news media involved. And in the grand scheme of things, the public is sort of like, okay, what is all this about?
Well, now, obviously, we're looking at this from a journalistic perspective, but it seemed to me, Amy, that this particular story, the Rosen case, had the public a bit more interested maybe than the AP story. I mean, they're both about leak investigations. So what made this story, you know, resonate more with folks?
I think part of what it is the idea of the claim of criminal involvement and what went from simple reporting and somebody doing their job and the AP story being something that was held on to for a while and a measured response so that there wasn't any question about national security. I think here people's attention was grabbed that there could be criminal charges filed here, and that's the big difference.
Well, the Justice Department said, Attorney General Holder said that they had not intended to file any charges against Rosen. They weren't going to file any charges against him. But it was sort of a legal pretext to be able to get the search warrant mm-hmm. to look at the emails. And I wonder if going into someone's emails and reading the content of them struck anybody, the public or the media, as more dangerous than looking at phone logs, who you called and when.
I think that was the clear issue here, which sort of got the public's attention, the whole possibility that the government could tap into your email and read the content of it. I mean, initially they said they only wanted to get the timestamp and who was talking to who and how long they were talking. And now all of a sudden they're talking about, okay, actually we wanted to see the emails. So at that point, you know, the public starts going, whoa, wait a minute, that's a little bit too much.
One of the things that both the White House, the president, said in his speech at the National Defense University, and then Attorney General Holder later talked about supporting congressional efforts to pass a federal SHIELD law, mm-hmm. something that's, you know, been tried before and really hasn't gone anywhere. And I just wonder if this might not be a, you know, ironically positive reaction to this whole thing. Or is this just, you know, momentary good PR that's not going anywhere?
Well, I think the president has supported that type of legislation since he's been in office, not as forcefully as he could, but he has supported that. I think Congress and certain members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, have been very hesitant to go along with that SHIELD law because certain parts of their particular parties don't think that it's something that's necessary.
And at the same time, you're hearing journalists across the country saying it's something that is necessary, but that the SHIELD law as proposed doesn't have the teeth to really go as far as what we need as a profession.
You know, not everyone agrees, by the way, that Rosen is the victim in this situation. There are critics who say the Justice Department was right to aggressively pursue him. They argue, for example, that he and the leaker may have jeopardized the life of a source within the North Korean government, or at the very least tipped off their government to our intelligence methods. So, you know, that kind of argument comes up every time the media leak a story about national intelligence. But I thought it was a little bit surprising, at least, that a Washington Post reporter who covers national defense issues, Walter Pincus, actually jumped on the bandwagon this time. He accused the media of, quote, circling the wagons rather than focusing on what he thought was harm to our national security.
And I think he brings up a very good point here. He's basically saying there's a difference between information that's leaked in a whistleblower case in which the government is doing something wrong and information that's leaked about a national security issue such as this, in which it actually shows that, wait a minute, we do have someone or some way of getting information out of North Korea that really has nothing to do with the government doing something that's illegal.
But journalists would argue historically, at least, that we can't leave it up to the government alone to decide what's a national defense or national intelligence issue. And that's why journalists are there. You can't prosecute us for doing our job. You may go after the leaker if you want to, but you shouldn't criminalize the reporter's behavior.
No, and that's part of the social contract that we have with the public, is that is the fourth estate in journalism. We are there to provide that check, that balance on what's going on in government, and to help make, not to make the decision, but to serve as that watchdog.
Well, before we leave this story for this week at least, what about Bob Schieffer's argument in that video clip that we just played? He says the leak investigations are indicative of a larger White House problem with lots of missteps having to deal with the press. You agree with that?
I would agree with that to a certain extent, but it's not anything that any other White House has had to face. I mean, former President Bush had to face the same thing, especially when you go back and look at what was going on with the rendition incidents. You can also go back to President Clinton when they were having to deal with the Monica Lewinsky affair. Mm-hmm. So I think every president has had to deal with this, with these kinds of issues.
And Schieffer was saying that straight out, that the hardest administration he's ever had to work with is the one that's currently in office, whoever it is you're dealing with at that time. There's some kind of roadblock each administration puts up in trying to make sure that its message stays best on track as it wants it to happen.
Well, while this Rosen case may be what we and other journalists have been talking about this week, the IRS targeting scandal still seems to be carrying more weight with the public. And we actually have a regional connection, sort of, to that story. Shortly after it came out, St. Louis TV reporter Larry Connors used his station's Facebook page to wonder out loud whether his recent troubles with the IRS might have stemmed from a tough White House interview he did with President Obama during last year's reelection campaign.
The economy is a big issue and concern for folks. I mean, the unemployment, trying to make ends meet, gas prices, food prices going up. Some of our viewers are complaining they just don't, you know, they get frustrated, even angered, when they see the first family jetting around, different vacations and so forth. Sometimes maybe they think under color of state business, and that you're out of touch, that you don't really know what they're experiencing right now.
Well, I don't know how many viewers you're talking about that say that.
We do hear from some.
Well,
yes,
I hear from all kinds of viewers about everything.
Yeah.
Well, a few years before that interview, the IRS had challenged some tax deductions claimed by Connors and his wife. The couple agreed to make monthly payments to cover the back taxes they owed. And then after that 2012 Obama interview, Connors says the IRS rescinded the payment plan. Well, last week, KMOV-TV made Connors read a short on-air statement saying that he might have stepped over the line with his Facebook comment and raised questions about his journalistic integrity in the process. Then the station fired the 66-year-old reporter who'd spent most of his 37-year career at KMOV. An attorney for Connors tells the station his client may sue. Well, Amy, was Larry Connors wrong to use the station's Facebook page to tie his beef with the IRS to the national story?
Well, he claims that he had been encouraged by the station to comment on news of the day. In my opinion, personally, yes, I think he was wrong to use the station's Facebook page to comment on what was ultimately his beef and tying a beef that had been going on for years to one interview. Looking back at the history of what's gone on between Connors and his wife and the IRS, at least from reports I've read, to tie it to this Obama interview is connecting dots that may not be connectable.
Ernest, do you think it was a mistake? And whether it was or not, is it a firing offense, in your opinion?
Well, it was definitely a mistake. He should not have put it up on the Facebook page. That was something that was going on personally with him. And to interject himself into a story like that because of something personal going on is basically a journalistic faux pas. In terms of what the station did, I think there are other ways that they could have handled it. They could have suspended him. They could have made sure that he wasn't covering stories that had anything to do with the IRS or with President Obama. There are other ways they could have handled it. But in today's environment, one mistake can cost you your job. We've seen it over and over and over again in various incidents involving not just people in the news, but you know, people in government and people in private corporations.
And this is one of the traps, especially with social media being relatively new and how it's being used in news coverage and in the promotion of news stories and trying to build relationships between personalities at television stations and audiences, there's still not a clear understanding in a lot of newsrooms as to what social media policies are and how to use these tools responsibly. And without having a copy of that station ownership group's social media policy, if one even is written and exists, there's no way to know ultimately if it was a fireable offense because it may not have been the most ethical act, but we don't know if it was actually against station or corporate policy.
At least as the general manager was quoted in other media, he really didn't make reference to social media policy, though. He basically said that if we kept him employed here at the station, especially as a highly prominent anchor and reporter, that it would make it very hard for them to cover anything having to do with politics or stories where now the station might be accused of political bias. I'm not saying that's far-fetched, but I'm not even sure I'm saying it's a stretch, but it's an interesting interpretation of how the public would react when large swaths of the public were defending Larry Connors, thought he was a very good journalist for many years, and probably wondered about the degree of bias that creeps into news all the time.
Well, I think to a certain extent that we in the media sometimes don't give the public its due when it comes to understanding what's a conflict of interest and what's not. We just air err on the side of let's just deal with it and make sure that there is no bias. Well, you know, human nature, there's always going to be some bias involved. And when we go out and we do something like this, you know, fire someone because of a statement that they made, the public can go, whoa, wait a minute, that's taking it a little bit too far. There are other ways in which you could have dealt with the problem.
There were, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, sometimes transparency is just as valuable as complete and total objectivity.
I wonder what you think of the argument made by at least a few viewers who wrote some letters to the editors to the Post-Dispatch, who suggested that really this was just a business decision, pure and simple, that was disguised as sort of ethical posturing. I mean, Connors is 66 years old. He was replaced after he was fired immediately on the 6 and 10 p.m. newscast, big moneymakers for the station, by a much younger, higher-rated sports anchor.
See, that's one of the things that the station risks having, because so much of television news is how it's perceived is cosmetic. It's all very surface level. And when a station makes a move like this, even if it is about an ethical decision, that's not always what the audience sees. And how things are perceived is just as important as what actually is going on there.
And there's always a potential to lose longtime viewers who are watching the news program because he was on it. And those people could leave and never come back. And the fact that if you're going for a younger audience, many of them aren't watching local television news to begin with. So that's kind of a very tricky issue to get involved in.
Well, studies still tell us that TV news is the first choice of most Americans, but many of us are turning instead these days to mobile media. And during the workday especially, that often means a desire to pull out your smartphone and snack on what we call quick news nuggets. Just get my information, get on about my daily life. And there are two media companies this week who reacted publicly to that trend. The first is the Financial Times of London. They already have one of the world's most successful pay models for digital content, and they announced that they were adding a new service called Fast FT. Now, Amy, what this is, according to the Financial Times news release anyway, is they're going to put out 150 to 300 word real-time stories that, quote, might affect the markets. And taking a little poke at Twitter, the company says that Fast FT will be there when, quote, 140 characters doesn't cut it. What do you think?
I think it's a brilliant move to be able to get nuggets of breaking news that are out there to people with enough context, because like they're saying, 140 characters doesn't always cut it, but 140 words or 300 words will give people enough of a story, enough context where it really could move markets, and it is going to give people information that they need in the time they need it.
I think what this is going to do and what others are doing in this area is going to really help when it comes to that quick news that you get online or on your smartphone, or on your iPad, because it's going to provide some context, which is what's missing if all you're getting is, you know, headlines and 140 characters and that sort of thing.
I think it also says something about how when people talk about a news organization having a digital strategy, that you have to have a lot of digital strategies, right? I mean, there's the strategy for people who are consuming information during the business day on their smartphones. There's another strategy for people who are using a tablet when they're at home. There are strategies for different demographics. There are social media strategies. It isn't as simple as it sounds, is it, Amy?
No, it really isn't. What you're really needing to do is find a way to build a loyal audience and know how to reach them at any point during that 24-hour period. So that's also including push notifications. If you have stories that are either breaking or are important enough where you want to remind them that something is out there and to come back maybe at a time that they may not necessarily be thinking about your product. It's making people feel like they have a connection and they need you as much as you need them.
Well, we also learned this week that there's another company, a mobile startup called Circa. They've hired away the social media editor at Reuters to expand their news offerings. And right now, for people who aren't familiar with Circa, they have editors, a small number of editors, I think about a dozen. They take stories from other news providers, from third parties. They summarize those stories in sort of easy-to-digest chunks that fit on the mobile phone screen. And you can follow stories that you're interested in, kind of like you could follow someone on Facebook or Twitter. And then every time Circa updates a story, just the update gets pushed to you, so you don't have to read the whole thing to get caught up on the story. Well, the new boss there at Circa, the new news boss anyway, says he wants to hire more editors and he wants to have his staff do more independent fact-checking of stories. Sounds like a good idea. And it also sounds like a competitor who understands that mobile audience pretty well.
Understands the mobile audience and understands the idea of catering for an on-demand audience. We are more and more developing on-demand habits and tastes and how we consume our news. And this is a product that's seeing that and finding a way to serve and cater to it from the ground floor.
I wonder too, Ernest, what this says about sort of these hybrid news organizations. I mean, in some ways, Circa sounds a lot like Newsy, which is here in town, where they don't do their own original reporting. They basically take other people's reporting, add a little bit of context, and then merge it all together into something that they can sell. And this sounds like, I mean, they're taking a handful of professional journalists who are doing essentially the same things with print content.
The part that's going to be that I'm going to be interested in is whether or not these reporters are going to be out actually covering the news. And if that's the case, now you're talking about a totally different model or a new model. What I would think you'd call a merging of traditional reporting on the ground reporting with the basically aggregation of news that are coming from other sources. That's going to take some capital. That's going to take some time to meld. So it's going to be interesting to see whether or not they can pull that off.
I do like their idea, if they can pull it off, of saying we're not just going to aggregate content, even when it's from usually reliable sources, but we want to do a bit more of our own vetting, our own fact-checking. That can't hurt either.
No, there's absolutely nothing wrong with more people being out there checking facts. One of the other things I find most interesting about the choice in this hire is that they pulled the social media editor from Reuters. They're hiring somebody who has a good sense of what it takes to reach people where they are, how to reach them in quick snippets and bring them in and creating shareable content from there. And I think that speaks volumes about where we're moving.
Well, whether you're a traditional news organization or a social media company, one of your biggest headaches is dealing with trolls and other folks out there who abuse your commenting systems to vent, you know, hatred. Facebook felt the heat on this week when feminist groups launched a coordinated campaign against the company for failing, as they said, to remove posts that they felt were hate speech against women. They pointed to Facebook pages such as one that was named "Violently Raping Your Friend Just for Laughs," and others that showed graphic images of women that were being physically abused. The protesters took to Twitter. They emailed advertisers seeking a boycott until Facebook took action that they felt was significant. At least one company, Nissan, announced they were pulling ads from the social network until Facebook could assure them that their ads wouldn't appear near such offensive content. I wonder, though, Amy, the way that ads are placed sort of automatically these days, how easy it would be for Facebook or anybody to assure a company their ad is not going to occasionally appear against that kind of content.
Oh, I don't know how that is possible. And the way Facebook ads show up, all I have to do is search for one thing once. I probably search for something having to do with weight loss once. And there was one day where I had 4 Dr. Oz weight loss ads that showed up. It could be somebody searching for something as simple as rape crisis hotline, and those ads are going to keep showing up. I think this is part of Facebook just trying after that IPO to keep the money coming in.
Is it a legitimate concern, though, Ernest, for these folks to be going after a social media site and saying you have to do something to rein in hate speech, however that's defined?
Well, because you're talking about activist organizations, I mean, this is the thing that they do. And if they see that something that they're passionate about is being attacked, then they're going to try everything that they can to try to stem that tide. And if that means going after Facebook, they go after Facebook. If they're going to intimidate the advertisers, they're going to intimidate the advertisers. And the advertisers are going to want to have to deal with it because, you know, they're trying to sell a product. Yeah. And if there's a possibility that their product is going to be damaged by being connected to this hate speech, they're going to pull it.
Well, meanwhile, a newspaper in Canada, in Winnipeg, decided to tackle the problem of trolls or obnoxious comments by announcing a different kind of policy. Starting next Monday, the only people who can comment on their site will be those people who've paid for a print or an online subscription. Well, we can see why they might do that, but they also got a lot of pushback, Amy, from folks who said, "Why should I have to pay for the right to express my opinion on your site?"
Well, because if you were to buy a newspaper and read an editorial and not agree with it, you can write a letter to the editor. It's just because it's out there doesn't mean that it's available for you to necessarily go ahead and make comment on. And it's no different, frankly, than a newspaper that would put up a paywall and that you have to pay to get to the content in the first place, in which case you couldn't see it if you didn't pay for it, hence you couldn't comment on it. I personally don't have a problem with this policy, and maybe that's after spending too many months and years moderating comments for a newspaper website.
Well, and in fact, they were asked by some people and addressed it in an FAQ, well, why don't you just moderate all the comments, and then you wouldn't have this problem? And they said, well, it would take forever. It's gone from a few comments to tens of thousands a day.
Too many man hours to try to moderate that. I mean, I think what this shows is that the person that owns the press can dictate how that press is going to be run, and the comments are part of that. And they're making a decision here that you have to be a subscriber, a paid subscriber to our newspaper in order to be able to comment.
And ultimately what they're trying to do is elevate the level of discourse going on those stories. And what they're trying to do is say flat out, we're not giving everybody free reign and free platform to go ahead and speak your mind simply because you're looking for a platform to do that. We want to make sure there's intelligent conversation and discourse here.
I think we all hope they succeed in that. We'll see what happens. Yeah. And we leave you this week with an unexpected embarrassment for CNN during its wall-to-wall coverage of the Oklahoma tornado. Wolf Blitzer was conducting a friendly interview with one of the survivors, a young woman who had her child in her arms, when Blitzer said this.
Well, we're happy you're here. You guys did a great job.
Yeah.
And I guess you got to thank the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Do you thank the Lord for that split-second decision?
I'm actually an atheist.
Oh, you are. All right. But yeah. You made the right call.
Yeah. Yep. We are here. And you know, I don't blame anybody for thanking the Lord.
Of course not. So.
Very interesting, Abby. I mean, I wasn't here. I was out of the country when this coverage was going on. But a lot of people, including my wife, were sending me comments about just how sort of treacly and offensive that the coverage was on CNN especially. And here in an attempt to try to, I don't know what, empathize with the average viewer or whatever, he really stepped in.
Oh, did he ever? And that woman, as you watch it, it's cringeworthy because you feel for her. She shouldn't have to explain her feelings or her beliefs at that point. And he's awkwardly putting her in a position of having to do so.
But she was, you know, she was good-natured about it, I thought, in her reaction.
Very, very much so. This goes back to me when I think about it. We tell our students all the time, let the person tell their story and don't try to interject. And quite often, reporters will try to show some empathy or to make some sort of connection when, in fact, the story just speaks for itself. And I think if he'd just allowed her to tell her story, he probably wouldn't have had that awkward moment.
But isn't this kind of the natural reaction to us trying to make our TV news anchors be more human and more empathetic with the public? I mean, Anderson Cooper, that's his whole shtick. And eventually something like this is going to happen, Amy.
Yeah, it's going to happen. And it's no different than when somebody sneezes and your gut reaction is to say, bless you. But at the same time, I think as journalists, just as Ernest was saying, what we should do is stand back and say to her, you know, what was your first thought after this happened? Or how do you make sense of this now? And not make it about God, not make it about religion.
Well, not to be unexpected at all, but of course, Glenn Beck had an explanation for it all. He argued that it wasn't accidental that some producer planted this atheist woman in front of Wolf Blitzer to advance her agenda. I don't know about that. But we've used up all of our time this week to talk about that story and the others, so thank you for listening and watching. The show is available for replay on our Links blog. You can also go there for stories related to our topics. Just look under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. Want to offer comments, questions, or story suggestions? You can send them to views@kbia.org. Our director is RJI's Travis McMillan. KBIA's Pat Akers handles audio. I'm Mike McKean. Amy and Ernest will join me again next Wednesday as we bid farewell to Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis on a special edition of KBIA's Views of the News.